Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello, everybody. Welcome along to our latest episode of the Early Excellence podcast. This week, we've picked out an episode to re-release that will really get you thinking about your practice and provision. So join me, Andy Burt, with Louise Herbert and Gareth Shaw as we answer all of the key questions around SEND in the early years. Louise and Gareth, hiya, how are you?
All right, very good, thank you.
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really good to have you on the podcast. We're going to be talking about basically all things special educational needs and disabilities, aren't we? All things SEND, really, as part of the podcast today. And would it be all right if we start with some introductions, because you've both got such a lot of experience, and it'd be great just to sort of give us that backdrop, really, in terms of, you know, what brings you to here and what brings you to the podcast. Would that be okay? So we'll start with Louise, if that's all right. Louise, can you give us a bit of an introduction?
Yeah, so I qualified as a teacher in 2008 with an early years PGCE. So early years is really, really my bag. I worked in a mainstream infant school for 7 years before moving to local authority work as a SEND advisor for children with a visual impairment. I then got a job as an assistant head in a special school. Worked there for a while and then decided that I'd try the big brave world on my own. And I started my own company, Insightful Beginnings, in January 2024. And I provide early years child development and special needs support for schools and families.
Very good. Thank you very much. And over to you, Gareth.
Hi, thanks. Yes. So I have worked in early years in schools, in earlier settings and children's centres and things for my whole career. Started working in schools just at the turn of the century and have worked in schools, earlier settings and things ever since. I worked with children with special needs, either in inclusive settings or in children's centres or in special schools as well through that time. And I'm delighted to be here having a chat about that this morning.
Very good. Thank you very much. I think, there are a couple of things I was going to say just as a starter, really. The first is that I'm sure everybody is aware that particularly it seems like over the last few years, there has been such a great need emerged. You know, that when we talk about children's needs within primary schools, every teacher that I meet, you know, as part of my role, whether that be in training or as part of consultancy or whatever it might be, everybody talks about the needs of the children on entry. Everybody is talking about the needs of the children in terms of all sorts of things, you know, from children who are autistic or who've got particular needs in terms of speech, language and communication, or in terms of really, sometimes it, purely in terms of sort of self-help skills or personal, social and emotional skills, that it seems that everybody has got at the moment so many issues that we're trying to deal with. And as a result of that, the conversation, I think, has widened within schools around special educational needs and disabilities. The other thing that I was going to say, the second thing, was that, and I think this applies to me as well, I think we have, when it comes to special educational needs and disabilities, I think we have quite often people feel that they don't have a level of expertise when possibly they know more than they think they know. Does that make sense? You know, I would never claim to be somebody who knew a lot about special educational needs and disabilities. And yet at the same time, when I think back over my career, I've worked with lots of children with all sorts of needs, and I've put together plans for them, and I've actually met their needs in all sorts of different ways. And yet I would never think about that as being something that I would even talk about as being a level of expertise. Does that make sense? I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think...
And I don't know whether that is the case for when you meet people, you know, as part of your work. Do you feel that?
I think I really do feel that. And I think a lot of the time we get imposter syndrome, don't we? And we kind of think there's always somebody else who knows more than we do. But actually, I think a lot of it is down to good practice and common sense. And just knowing your children, and teachers know their children, particularly in early years. It's so, so important.
Yeah, I guess that's my thinking on that as well, really, that people tend to know more than they think they do. There's a Dr. Spock quote there, isn't it, about trust yourself, you know more than you think you do. The child development Dr. Spock, not the other one. And if you know about child development and you know your children, you're looking at how the children within your classes kind of map onto what you'd expect in terms of typical child development, and you're seeing where children are working in different ways and experiencing the world perhaps differently to what you would commonly expect, then that's the most important bit of knowledge that you can have and that you can get across. And I kind of think that's one of the central messages I think we're probably going to go through this in this podcast, is that that understanding of your children is really the key that unlocks many other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we met, didn't we? So a couple of months ago now, and we got together in the run-up to the recording of the podcast. And what we've done is we've put together a series of questions that are kind of almost like, I suppose, frequently asked questions, really, that we feel that through dealing with these questions within the podcast, actually, we feel that we can support quite a lot of people. And so hopefully people will find this useful. Should we go straight into question one that we put together? Okay, so here we go. So we started off with what if I've got a child in my class with different needs to the other children? Okay, so a fairly generic question there. What if I've got a child in my class with needs that are different to the other children? Okay, who's going first?
Go on, Gareth. Do you want to, or I don't mind?
Okay, yeah, I mean, I think that the very first thing that you need to do is apply those classic cornerstones of good practice of interaction, observation, and teamwork with the other people that are within your setting, within your classroom on a daily basis. So have a look, see what that child is doing, see how you can apply that to child development, and have a talk with the other people in your team about what they are also seeing. Are they witnessing the same thing when they play with that child, when they talk and converse with that child? Are your experiences similar? How are they different? And, you know, I think that's your first port of call is that looking at trying to kind of understand where the child is coming from and then thinking about whether what you think fits with the other people within your team.
Very good. Thank you. Anything to add, Louise?
Yeah, I think it's also about making sure that you're having those early conversations with parents, isn't it? Because obviously parents are absolutely key in this journey. I think the other thing to remember is, particularly in the early years, it's really difficult sometimes to differentiate between the age of the children and the ability and developmental sort of stage of the children, because that gap is so broad in terms of your autumn term children compared to your summer term children. Particularly in nursery and reception, there's a massive difference for children who turn four in September to those who turn four the following August in nursery, and likewise reception when they're five. But I think, in truth, you do know, and trust your gut, but make sure that you're bringing parents along on that journey with you. And I think a really important thing that I used to do in school was, as part of the induction process before any of the children started school, have that conversation with parents and just kind of say, look, sometimes we may have to have difficult conversations with you. We don't want to do that. We don't enjoy doing it. But it's really important to know that if we do have a difficult conversation with you and we say that we're worried about your child's development or progress, that it's not a personal attack on you. So from the off, before those conversations were had, I always made sure that parents knew the reasoning behind difficult conversations. So I could always remind them back to kind of actually, you know, when we had the induction meeting and we talked about it, this isn't an attack. It's not a criticism of your parenting, but actually it's because we want the best out of your children or your child.
Yeah. And I think that ongoing conversation has to start, like we say, from before day one, really. But also it has to be backed up by a whole host of other conversations that you've had with them that have just been that general handover conversation. Or they've, you know, these are the things they've done today. They really enjoyed playing in the sand today. They really, all that sort of, because then over time, those conversations will have all the elements of things that you might be concerned by or might be flagging in those, you know, enables you to, in a much more natural way, approach those conversations and say things along the lines, you know, oh, we noticed so-and-so does this thing. Have you noticed something like that at home? It doesn't become a threatening thing when you suddenly have to say to a parent, oh, we're worried about this thing, you know, because you've had just that casual ongoing dialogue about all the things that the child's been doing. They've been getting up to all sorts of different things, and you're not waiting that as either a fantastically brilliant thing or a I'm really worried about this thing. It's just, this is the matter of fact things that are going along. You're having that ongoing conversation, which enables you to have all your other conversations in a much more relaxed space from knowledge.
Yeah. And that's about the quality of the transition process, isn't it? You know, I'm a big advocate of things like, say, home visits, if it's possible. That I think there is such, you can gain such a lot of information. And that's not just for finding out particular needs of the children, of special educational needs. It's actually about building those relationships, isn't it? About meeting people where they feel hopefully most comfortable, in order that actually you gain that relationship, you gain that trust with the parents, but also, of course, you see the child within their home environment. And that if a child is, say, talking within their home environment, you know that you to expect that they would be talking when they're at school or within your setting. Whereas actually sometimes, you know, we're in the dark, aren't we? We don't know whether actually that child is talking at home or not. We don't know the other side of their life. And so, yeah, whilst it is a big undertaking to do something like home visits, and it can be a logistical nightmare, I get that. But at the same time, you know, it does get you off on the right starting point where you've got that trusting relationship, so that if you are needing to have a difficult conversation, it feels actually like it's built on a strong foundation of trust, not just on having to meet with somebody that you think, well, I don't even know this person. I don't know how they're going to react. And so on.
I think the other key thing as well is to ensure that you always listen to parents, because you always will have those children who mask in school and who really, really struggle at home. And I think back to when I started teaching and I'd have parents have those conversations with me. I'd raise it with Senkos and whatever and be like, oh, no, it's behaviour, it's parenting. And actually, I think we've come a really long way in understanding children's masking, and actually the fact that some children appear to cope very well in school, but actually they're really, really not. And I think if we listen to parents and kind of appreciate their difficulties that they're having with their children at home, we can make little tweaks in our day that really support the parents and the children.
Exactly. Yeah. Just because they are masking doesn't mean to say that they should be masking, and doesn't mean to say that there isn't things that we can do in our schools and settings that will help their holistic development. Because, you know, One of the most glorious things about the early years is that we're not just in it for the time when children are with us. We're in it for the entirety of a child's life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to question two then. How do I adapt my practice to meet the needs of all children? Okay. Should we stick with the same order? Should we go with Gareth first? Is that all right?
Yeah, of course. Well, actually, I was just thinking there's one thing we didn't mention actually in that kind of first section that we probably should have done, which is, we mentioned the teamwork with other people that you're working with on that, you know, daily basis. I'd hope you're also working probably daily with your Senko, but actually being in contact with your Senko early on to have the discussions with them about what your concerns are or what your observations are. What you think about the different needs within your class, about individuals and about groups, and getting that person involved as early as you can, if only to be, you know, have early information about things, but also if possible, getting them involved to get their support. So I think in terms of that leads us into this adapting practice thing, that if you're going to make changes, making sure that you've got the right people involved in supporting you with any changes that you do make.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Next question then, and we'll go to Louise for this one. How do I adapt my practice to meet the needs of all children? Louise, over to you.
I think one of the beautiful things about early years is that we can adapt our teaching. It's less prescriptive than the rest of the national curriculum. But likewise, these kind of things can be useful for the rest of school as well. So for me, good adaptive teaching is good teaching, full stop. So things like official timetable, children need to know what they're doing. We need to know what we're doing. If I had a week without my Outlook calendar, I would be in complete meltdown because I wouldn't know what was happening and when. And children really, really need to understand that as well. So for some children, official timetable's enough. For some children, they might need an hour next board or a first next and then, just so that they understand what's happening. And also to support them in doing activities that they might necessarily not want to do as much, but to help them find a variety of activities. And sometimes things like sensory circuits can be really, really useful for the whole class. I used to say for my children to get your wiggles out for singing in the morning, which was always really lovely. But actually a sensory circuit and movement break is so, so important. As adults, we can't sit for hours and hours on end without a movement break. And I don't think we should expect children to either. And I think that's a really key message, not just in early years, but actually going throughout the school, that we can't expect children to do what we can't do ourselves. And I think we're very much in danger of that, particularly as children get older. And I think, I mean, there's an awful lot of things you can put in place. Gareth, have you sort of got any?
Thinking of your comments there made me think of a few other points about that sort of, you were talking about the visuals and personalising those. And I think that's such a key thing about it. So often people do have a visual timetable or do try some of those visual strategies, but the key to most of them working effectively is to tailor them to make them fit the needs of that child. Things like what particular pictures you use. It could be you have to use the photographs of the things. It could be you have to start off with, you know, objects of reference, a real item, and showing them and sticking them on a board to show the order. There's all sorts of different ways of changing things to see which way works. You know, sometimes, oh, I've tried visuals, it didn't work. And you're talking about, well, what sort of visuals did you use? And they're doing their best. I'm not criticizing that, but yeah, that they've done one way and then it hasn't worked. So they're saying, oh, that's not working. What bit of that isn't working? How can I change that thing to make that work? If the demand for moving from one thing to another is too great from an adult doing it, maybe a child asking that other child to move on with them, maybe that's the thing that they need. Adapting things that way. And the other thing, I was just to talk about the sensory circuits there, and I was just thinking how, you know, putting things like that at the right point in the day, you know, so sometimes, you know, we get lots of really great ideas. We put them in practice, and they work okay, but they're not working as well as they could do because we've kind of dropped them in where we had time because there was assembly at this time, there was PE at this time, this thing at the other time. And so I put in those things at 1 o'clock. It's actually, they would be brilliant if you put them at 9 o'clock. So it's adapting and being kind of looking at kind of the whole timetable and the whole routine and seeing how you can make things work.
And I think it's about being consistent, isn't it? If you try something new that either, I don't know, a consultant's recommended or you've read about it on the internet and you've tried it once and you think, oh, that doesn't work, it won't if you've tried it once. I always say to anybody that I work with or anybody, any school settings that I support, give it a whirl for a good couple of weeks, because like anything, if you go on a diet for one day, you're not going to lose a stone. It's got to be consistent. And I think if you try something consistently and then it doesn't work, try something else. That's absolutely fine. But I think it's really important to know that you can't fix something. You can't fix a situation after one day of inputting something new. Children love routine, but they do take time to adapt to new routines and adapt to your adaptive teaching. So it is really important that you do give things a good try. And I always say, I'm not too proud that if something hasn't worked, that we change it. But all I ask is that you try it more than once.
That's right. And any change can be threatening. You've made a change already. It was different. It might be a really good thing, but it's just going to be threatening to start with. The sympathy with which you initiate that change, and then your perseverance and your dedication to making it work for that individual, it is so crucial.
It really is.
Yeah. Can we go back to something that you both mentioned? Sensory circuits. I'm aware that not everybody will be familiar with what we mean by sensory circuits. So I wondered whether you'd be able to give us an example of what that might be like in practice. You know, what sorts of things would you be exploring with your children? What sorts of things would you do as a routine, as a sort of a sensory circuit or a bit of a break?
So sensory circuits, there's a set sort of patterns. I mean, it's come from, I believe, the occupational therapy world. So it starts off with a movement activity, like a stimulating activity. So where it really, really gets children moving. So it could be jumping up and down on the spot, running up and down the field. It can be done in a small group or as a whole class. I've seen it work really, really successfully as a whole class. And then you go on to an organizing activity, which still involves gross motor movements, but you have to think about it. Your body has to think about it more. So it might be balancing along a sort of a strip of paint on the floor whilst picking up something from your right and your left and then depositing it in the bucket or something like that. So it's physical, but your body and your brain has to organize itself to do it. So it's a little bit more calming than the initial activity. And then you go into a calming activity after that, which might be a hand massage or a foot massage. I've seen it in classes where the children do sort of peer massaging of each other's hands. You can have a weighted blanket and some calming music. There's all sorts of things that you can do as long as it calms the child. So yep, stimulating, organising, calming. And you can do that as part of a small group. And the idea is that it regulates children's sensory needs. So obviously we know about a lot of children's sensory needs, and sensory needs are a lot of the reason as to why certain behaviours are displayed, which we'll touch on later. But actually, in addressing those sensory needs, you can do it sort of a couple of times a day, first thing after lunch, just before you start lessons again or start continuous provision again. But it just means that children who do really need that sensory input get it. And actually, it's not going to harm any child that doesn't need it either, and it really helps those that you might not realize need it. So your maskers, for instance, the children that are sort of keeping it all in for the day and then really struggling when they get home, it can be a really, really good way of focusing the children. And I know it's another thing to add into the day, but it's good physical development, it's good concentration, it shows and develops listening skills. So there's a lot of different areas of development involved in sensory circuits. So I think it's a really, really good thing to put into your practice.
Yes. Yeah, great. And the other thing I wanted just to go back to as well is you both mentioned masking. And I wondered whether you could go into a little bit of more detail on, you know, what you know, basically, I suppose, examples of that, or kind of what to look out for, maybe, you know, if children are masking, what sorts of things do you tend to notice? Or maybe it's more difficult, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it can be difficult because obviously that's the nature of having something masked. And I think we kind of rode into that as a thing from thinking about parent communication. And that's something which often comes up within supporting children with SEND is, we're all different when we're at home to what we're at work, and children are different when they're at school to when they're at home to when they're at, you know, pubs or whatever other, you know, organisations they might be part of. And I guess masking really as a term is just referring to the way that many children are able to cover behaviours or habits and things in some contexts, but not in others. And often in those contexts where they're most relaxed, they will then demonstrate some of their kind of ways of coping with those things later on. I think that's kind of one way of thinking about that. And it can be difficult to identify, but it doesn't mean to say that it's not something which we need to reconsider when children are in schools and settings, because they are. So often masking behaviors take a lot of energy and a lot of cognitive ability and a lot of effort to maintain. Talking about a child, it is masking their initial desire might be to remove themselves from a situation or to not engage with something or whatever, but they're taking a lot of effort to do some to manage that. All of that effort is obviously effort which they're not putting into processing the learning information which is coming in or processing the social information and those sorts of things. So that work with parents is really key to try and understand what they might be doing in order, because actually if we can help with those things, they are going to be effectively make more progress with development than that.
And the other thing I think as well is if you've got a child whose parent has sort of said to you, they're having a complete meltdown every single day when we come in from school, I can't console them, I don't know what to do with them, that to me is an indication that something is happening at school. At that point, I think it would be really useful to either take a step back and observe that child in class or ask Yusenko to do so. And I know everybody's workload is enormous, but actually what you can sometimes see is children who are masking will be the children who are absolutely compliant. But if you say, I don't know, children, go and get your coats on, they will be a split second behind because they're following the cues of the other children. So there's no fuss, there's no behaviour issues, but you can see that their processing is a little bit behind and they're waiting for those cues from others. And that's something that you wouldn't notice sitting in front of a class of 30. So I think sometimes it's about taking a step back as class teacher and looking at an individual child, because it tells you so much information that you can't always get with the best one in the world when you're controlling and teaching 30 at once.
Yeah. Actually, something I'm a real kind of try and be a real champion for is the fact that if you ask most people who work with children of any age, you know, who are the children or young people that are causing the most concern, those at the top of the list will be those who display the most extroverted behaviour by and large. They'll be those who are likely to have loud outbursts or have significant periods of emotional dysregulation where they're causing all sorts of difficulties for other children in the class. But actually, there are many, many children for whom you would never think they've got a behavioural issue. We have a really huge behavioural issue because they are not engaging for the things that you are wanting them to engage with. They are not learning the way that you want them to learn because they are either not able to, or they are refusing to, or, and you don't know in individual cases what's going on, but actually that is just as much of a behaviour issue. It's not a behaviour issue for you in that you're not having to protect yourself from violence or whatever, but actually it's a behaviour issue in that the same outcome that is happening for the child.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yeah.
And nobody wants children to be uncomfortable in their classroom. You don't go into this unless you're a really caring person. And actually, none of us want the children in our care to feel any form of discomfort. So I think it's about getting to know your children, really, really spot those signs and support. Like you say, it's about making sure that they're all equally supported, whether they're displaying sort of inverted commas challenging behaviors or otherwise. Actually, we want our children to be comfortable in our presence in our classroom.
With adapting practice, I was just going to come back to that question that we had there. Yeah, how we adapt practice is really about looking at those individual children and all of those children and trying to then think, how can I make it better for them? That is what we are trying to do, isn't it? I've never met anybody in a school who went into working in a school or an earlier setting with anything other than wanting to make the world a better place for those individuals.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Okay, which brings us actually quite nicely on to our third question. What's the best way to support a child whose behaviour is causing concern?
For me, I think this is probably the question that I get asked the most. And I think it's something that teachers find really, really challenging. Because of the safety of other children in the class as well if it's really quite extreme. But I think the answer to this is always the why. What is the cause of this behaviour? And I know sort of back in the day we used to look at the ABC charts, the antecedent behaviour consequence. For me, the consequence is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. However, the behaviour you're seeing and what went before it, the A and the B, is absolutely crucial. Because if you can see patterns, you can limit that behaviour. And things like sensory circuits, sensory breaks, rest breaks, a quiet den can be really, really helpful for some children. But it might be, it could be anything that's triggering behaviour. It could be a busy lunchtime, in which case, can you set up a little lunchtime group in the classroom? Because I can guarantee the child displaying the behaviour won't be the only child struggling with it. It's just that that is the way that they're communicating their difficulties to you. But I think behaviour is definitely a challenge, and it's about being consistent, isn't it? Providing boundaries, keeping your visual timetables so that children know what's coming next. It's often that element of surprise that really, really triggers children, or that element of change, unexpected change at home and school. And I think that is really, really challenging. But again, have the luxury, take the time to observe individual children and find the why.
Yes, that's very good. Those are very good points.
Yeah, I think quite often those children who we, you know, quote unquote, you know, label as having behavioural difficulties. And I'm not saying children don't, but, you know, but often those are almost like the indicators of where some of the difficulties might lie for all the children. If all the children are finding out, if you've got a child who really does not want to enter the lunch hall for lunch, there's a reason for that. The reason could be, you know, the smell, the volume, could be the location, whatever. But actually, that child is telling you probably the other children who are also finding it the same. It's just that child probably doesn't have that kind of social awareness or the niceties to the social norm to be able to deal with it in the way that the others are. And so if you're changing that thing, because some of the things that you sometimes hear from people, well, we're changing it just for that one child. But actually, you're not changing for the one child. You're changing it for the one child who's really made it clear to you that that thing isn't working.
I think we also, as I said earlier, we expect so much from our children in situations that we would, as adults, find really uncomfortable. If I had to eat a meal in a school dinner hall, I would struggle with the noise. And I'm, as far as I know, neurotypical, as much as any of us are. But actually, I would not enjoy my eating experience in a noisy school hall. And I've been in school halls recently where the children have requested things like tablecloths and round tables. And actually, even the way that tablecloths absorb a little bit of extra noise, it makes it a much more inviting place for children. It feels a little bit less like you're sort of churning out in a factory. But I think a lot of those behaviours come from the fact that we expect so much of children. And if we were to put ourselves as adults in those positions, we would struggle as well. We would just know how to mask and how to get through it, but we'd probably lie down afterwards.
If we come back to child development, children are the least able to cope with huge levels of, or significant levels of sensory input, social input. We expect to be sociable all day long, yet they are the least able to cope with it compared to adults. But most adults in the situation of having to be constantly social all day long, 5 days a week, I suspect many of us would struggle. I know I would struggle to be that socially engaged all day long.
Yeah.
We expect children to simply do it. And so any things that you can do that support that are really key. I just want to go back to the thing about children, how best to support children with behaviour concerns, really. And just actually the very first point that Louise made about behaviour being communication. Behaviour is communication. The behaviour and the reasons for that communication are obviously the most important. We often put a lot of effort into the what do we do when such and such a thing happens. And those things are important. How we respond to behaviour is really important. but it doesn't tend to necessarily actually solve the problem that the child is experiencing that is causing that behavior. But in all the rewards or punishments or sanctions or anything else you can put in, and there's often lots of discussions about, are sticker charts right or wrong? Should they be used? Shouldn't they be used? Have we changed that? Should be a whole class reward? Should it not be? Should we have a ray of sunshine or a rainbow or whatever? And I'm not saying those things aren't necessarily important discussions to have, and that's kind of beyond the remit of right now. But what I would always say is the actual most important thing for dealing with the behavior is what you actually do to deal with the source of that behavior. The reward or the punishment or anything else is very unlikely to deal with the reason why the child did that.
Yeah. And that's a weird different mindset, isn't it? It's the mindset of kind of dealing with the source rather than just saying, right, it's either a big positive or it's a kind of or it's some kind of punishment. That actually, you know, we're getting beyond that.
Absolutely. And it's changing things to make things better for that child or make things better for many other children. But it's also not a, sometimes you get this sort of knee jerk, but we're then giving them everything that they want. You know, anything. Well, yeah, but that's the point. That's why we're here. And it's not about rewarding the behavior you didn't want, but it's about changing what you're doing in order to stop that behavior happening in the first place.
Yeah.
It's a very different thing to changing something to reward something happening.
And it makes everybody's life easier, doesn't it? And I think it's about being reasonable. I mean, I was in a school the other week where a child massively, massively struggled in assembly, and you could see he could not cope. So I suggested, he wanted to learn to touch type, which is a really useful skill for life. And I suggested that he used assembly time to practice his touch typing. I was told no. Every child has to go to assembly. No. And it's like, well, who is this for? Who is it helping? Because it's not helping him. It's not helping you, because then you're dealing with the behaviour, which is his way of communicating that he's struggling with that. He's then taking that behaviour home. He's feeling anxious about assembly all weekend, when actually it could be solved with a really, really simple, reasonable adjustment. And it, like you say, it's not about giving in. It's about doing the right thing. Yeah. I just want to also touch on that point, the fact that it's really, really important, I feel, that all staff have attachment and trauma training in schools, because often behaviour, again, as a result of communication, but can be attachment or trauma related. And so many children have been through trauma or attachment that actually I think it's really, really important that as practitioners, we have all had that training and we all understand the difficulties that looked after children will face, that children who've witnessed domestic abuse will face, or children of parents with mental health, loads and loads of things. But actually so many children have experienced early trauma that's affected their brain development. And I just feel that it should be as mandatory as safeguarding training in schools. I think it's really, really key in supporting children.
That's a really important point. Let's move on to our next question. Okay, next question. I think this is so important. It's one of my pet hates, what we're going to be talking about. The question is, how do we avoid exclusion by inclusion? Okay, and as I say, it's one of my pet hates, the idea that actually children who might have been identified as having a particular need, whatever that need might be, and that child sort of spends half of their time not even in the room with all of the other children. When I think that actually, you know, if we're talking about so many different things, usually the best place for it to happen is within the social environment, within the space where actually children are engaging with alongside their peers. Often they have things that they enjoy, that they feel most comfortable doing. And often, you know, to take that child out of that space, that's another change for them. When actually we often know, as we said earlier on, that change is something that they will often find more difficult. So I'm really, really pleased that this is something that we're looking at and we're talking about. So how do we avoid exclusion by inclusion? Louise, should we go to you first?
So again, I think this is a really, really important point, because we get, as a school, we might get an EHCP through and it says you need this support, that support, this intervention, speech and language support, communication support. And you think, oh, right, we've got to take out this child with his with his TA, and everything's got to be done individually. Firstly, as you say, these interventions can be done in the classroom. You could develop some continuous provision around the child's targets, and they might need a little bit more support within their play to achieve those targets or those outcomes, but it can completely be done. The other thing is, sometimes for me, you do need a quieter space to work in than your classroom allows. However, the child that you're working with is not probably or most likely the only child in that room who would benefit from that intervention. So are there any other children, for instance, if it's a speech and language intervention that they need, are there other children that would benefit from joining their group for that? So rather than being one-to-one, it might be 1-to-3. So you get the education and you get that social interaction as well. So I think a lot of it can be done in a group, even if it's really, really bespoke support, I don't know, like Braille teaching. Other children, you could have a child reading a Braille book next to a child who's reading a print book with the in the learning the same letters at the same time. It's about being creative, knowing your children, knowing your class, and knowing who will work well, who's a good role model, and who else needs support with that. So think about the location of where you're providing your interventions, but also the grouping.
I mean, I think we often end up with lots of micro exclusions happening, essentially, in that children, so many things get viewed as being intervention based. But, you know, this child needs this, there's an intervention for that, here it is, pull that one off the shelf. Here, this child needs this, intervention for that, let's pull that one off the shelf and do that. And what a lot of these things actually then undermine is the inclusiveness of and our own philosophy on the importance of play. If we speak to the vast majority of people within the early years, I would hope one of the first things they would say that they value is play.
Yeah.
And it's something that which goes through it still goes through the UFS, through the core of that, despite all the revisions it's had. It goes through the center of everything that we do. But the first thing that happens often happens when we have a child with SEN is let's do an intervention for that. And the intervention becomes separate to play, something different to play. And we have conversations about, well, we can't get the child to do the intervention. And it's like, well, because you've taken them away from doing the thing they really like doing to do the intervention that actually they don't see the purpose of. So we also then remove all the other things that we say are really important for children, following their interests, doing things which are important to them, all those things. And so how we ingrain that SEN work within your continuous revision within your typical class-based and setting-based support is really, 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 really important, because if we're then to remove things from that structure, you know, we undermine why we value it. I don't say everything can be done like that, but some things are better taken out from that situation. There is no doubt about that. Always thinking how we do it that way, and also how if we are doing some interventions, obviously, absolutely, key to many things. How do we make that play-based?
Yeah.
How do we change the thing from being where speech and language targets now, you know, here's five pictures of cats, you know, whatever, you know, here's a dog, make dog noise, here's a cat, make cat noise, whatever. You know, how do you actually make that a play-based experience that the child actually wants to do? Otherwise, children go through this process of having micro-exclusion all the network class anymore. They might as well.
Yes. And also, which I think it's really important as well, do all adults in your class know what the children are working on? Because, I don't know, if everybody in the class knows that they're trying to develop a three-step sentence or follow three-step instructions, every adult in that class can focus on that during play and continuous provision. So things like one-page profiles are really, really useful for children, so that you know the targets, that everybody knows the targets that they're working on. And mix your adults around as well. Children don't want to just see one adult all the time. They don't need to be velcroed to a teaching assistant or an LSA for the duration of their schooling. It can be hard work as well for an adult. And actually, I think sometimes it's easy to forget that as a class teacher, all of the children in your class are your responsibility. mix it up a little bit. If everybody in the class knows what all children are working on, everybody can support everybody within class rather than having to do everything out of class as well.
That's right. And they can do it all the time. And then the speech and language intervention isn't something which happens three times a week when so-and-so comes along and takes you out and does your targets. It happens every single interaction they have with every single adult throughout the entire week. And hopefully that's going to be...
Yes, yeah. The other point I think that links with what we're talking about here in terms of that idea of exclusion by inclusion is that I think it's important to acknowledge that we all as human beings want to feel that we belong, that we are a part of something, whatever that might be, a family, a group, or and the same goes for a class of children, that we all want to feel that we belong to that group or that class. And the same for young children within that, for young children within that class, they want to feel that they belong to that group. And I think, if we go down that route too much of taking children out, they stop feeling that they're part of it and they become almost like a visitor to the classroom rather than actually they are part of that group. And many children with special educational needs and disabilities, they struggle socially as well. Children with speech and language difficulties struggle socially, etc. And I think quite often we're creating a division there that doesn't have to be there, that often will set children up for difficulties later on. That children from an early age notice that another child is different, don't they? From a very, at 3, 4, 5, they will notice that another child is different. And that actually there's a division there that is already opening up that means that child is going to find it socially more difficult when they're 9, 10 and 11, probably. So I think we've got to be really careful with that.
But this is, again, why early is so golden for these things, because children will notice there's a difference, but will accept the difference as being, well, often accept the difference as being just intrinsic to that child is like that. As a matter of fact, they're often not bothered by that. They're not even necessarily particularly interested in that because it's another person. That other person's like that thing. That other person likes wearing red. That person does that thing. One of those other things. And so if we can, right from within the early years, they can take through that notion that this is just another way that one person is different from another person, value those individuals as much as anybody else, then that child will remain valued and a valued member of the class in the same way as everybody else is. If they're never there, they become the child who just appears from time to time. You don't really know what they do.
And also we need our children to be independent, don't we? And I think one of the biggest things I notice between mainstream and special schools, if you've got a child with a one-to-one in a mainstream school, they are completely dependent often on that one-to-one. And I think what we need to do is support parents to understand that a one-to-one isn't always the best way. Sometimes children need them for medical needs and to keep them safe. However, they still don't need them Velcroed to them. The difference, I think, in special schools is because you very rarely get one-to-one support in a special school. It's very high ratios, but it's very seldom one-to-one. Special schools do a really good job at making independence and advocacy part of their curriculum because they've got the freedom to do that. But I think we sometimes miss that in mainstream, and actually it's easier to do things for children because it takes longer. And I always have this conversation with parents when I do any sort of welcome to school meetings. It's easier to put your child's shoes on because it's quicker, but actually you're making them more independent if they can do it themselves. But it's about thinking about what do I want the children to do? And all they learn with a full-time one-to-one often is that this person does it better than me.
I often turn these things back to how I would feel as an adult, how we would feel as an adult. How would we feel as an adult having somebody with us, every minute of the school day who wasn't a friend, was just someone who came and did stuff with us the whole time. And you don't have a choice about that. So you remove the choice of who they spend time with. And they've got to be stapled to somebody else. I would find it horrendous to have somebody stapled to me all day long. So actually giving them that space to do that. And I think those things, comes back to what I was trying to say earlier about undermining some of our central philosophies are about independence and about play and about social interactions and about managing things for yourselves and about looking at your own interests. If you've got somebody with you the whole time, you're not doing any of those things. So you're not actually engaging in the earliest curriculum in the way that we all tend to view the earliest curriculum as being professional.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point, because I think quite often that idea of sort of having a one-to-one is a thing that often we are all striving for. You know, it feels almost like that's the holy grail. We want to get to that point where that child has got a one-to-one. But I think you're right. I think that actually we need to question that sometimes. We need to have a bit of caution around that. It has become the default setting that actually that's what we're all aiming for if there's a child with particular needs.
Things all about failure. We build a tower of bricks, the tower of bricks falls over. How do I make the tower of bricks better next time? If you have someone next to us the whole time saying, oh, I don't think you should do it like that, what have you thought about that? Oh, do you know what? That'd get right on your nerves, wouldn't it? But actually, you know, we have to fail things to then do better at things. Often a child who has a one-to-one doesn't get that chance to do that. They're, like the same thing is they get what they get chances for someone to tell them all the time they're doing it wrong without the opportunity to learn how to.
Yeah, and when you think about the characteristics of effective learning, which is obviously one of the golden threads of the EYFS, we're not providing children with those characteristics if we do everything for them or preempt, like you say, Gareth, everything that they're about to do and tell them that they're going to do it wrong.
Yes, which brings us on to our final question, which is how do I apply for an EHCP? How do I apply for an EHCP? Now, where should we go? Should we go with Gareth first? Gareth.
Okay. Well, so I think that the first and most important thing about EHCPs is evidence, having the evidence that you need and the evidence from your observations and from really identifying what needs really are that child has and the difficulties that they are facing and the strengths that they have in terms of their education based on the evidence you've got. So you know, always remember, it really is in education, health and care plan. It's the effect of health on education, care on education, and it's about their education. So really think about progress they are making. Yeah, the evidence for that, and that's really your very first port of call, is to make sure you've got a secure base of evidence to work with, to start with.
And I think the other really important point is to educate yourself as a school. And I think quite often we go along, we follow local authority policies and procedures, and actually, when you look at the Children and Families Act 2014, the legal test to assess a child for an EHCP is that a child has or may have special educational needs and may need special educational provision. So the actual legal bar is really low. So I'm not saying kind of chuck everybody in for an assessment, but if you know that a child needs an assessment and have that conversation with their families and either they can do it themselves or you can do it sort of as a partnership. If you know that a child has needs and that they should be entitled to an assessment, stick to your guns. If the answer is no, go to mediation, go to tribunal, because the legal test to assess, the bar is so low that actually it's important that you follow your heart really with that, because children will need that support. Again, I think a lot of schools think, oh, we'll get one-to-one if we get an EHCP. For me, adults can be used in a much better way. That EHCP isn't going to be the answer to everything, but it can often provide children with an awful lot of support. And obviously, if children are then at any point, if they want to move on to a special school, if parents want them to move to a special school, they will need that in place. But I really think it's important to know your law, and it's all Googleable. It's there in black and white. Whatever the local authority advice is, it doesn't trump the law.
Yeah, that's very good advice.
I think coming back here to parents and their role in your communication and your work with them is really, really vital. That time that you are gathering that evidence, you need to also be, and it doesn't necessarily have to be long, say all that time. I mean, it depends on the needs that child has, depending on how long that process is. I'm not trying to suggest you wait years on that. It's quite the opposite. You can make sure you've got what you've got. But while you're doing that, alongside of that, there is conversation and there is work and discussion and genuine partnership with parents about that, rather than a one day coming to the parents and saying, we're going to do this thing. And the parents being kind of, yeah, having the rug pulled from under them suddenly about, hang on a minute, you've said this. But if you have that ongoing dialogue there and you support them with that as well, it's really, really, really crucial. Team on board.
Yes.
It is absolutely, yeah, absolutely crucial. And you won't get there by waiting to the crisis point and talking to them about it. Then it only happens by having dialogue about children regularly.
And there is no minimum term of advice either. If your local authority says, oh, you need 2 terms of evidence, that isn't in the law either. It's advice, and you don't have to follow that as a school. If you have a child who starts reception with really quite profound needs, apply for that EHCP straight away, because the legal test to assess, do they have or may have SEN, and do they need provision? If you're already providing extra to them, yes, they do. They don't need a diagnosis for an EHCP. A lot of people believe that they will only get an EHCP with a diagnosis. It's needs-based, not label-based.
And presumably if a child has just started within your setting and that's what you want, that's the route that you will need to go down in terms of applying for that EHCP, you will need to work not just with parents but potentially with previous settings.
Previous settings as well, again, but if you think about the legal test, it's if the EHCP is agreed to be assessed, it's the responsibility then of the EP, everybody who's involved in that assessment, to establish need.
Yes. Yeah.
But working with previous setting is really, really useful. And I think also I work with a lot of private nurseries, PVI settings, that don't realise that they can apply for EHCPs. They think it's things that only schools can do, and that's not the case at all. So I think it's about supporting all settings to know and understand the process.
I think there's some of the key points about the evidence you present are trying to present what it is that child really needs support with. You know, offer examples of things which the child has done or has either done or managed to do or managed to not do. The factors were that either supported that or hindered that. And then what you did around that is really, really, really crucial to that, because it gives that indication of need and a sort of an indication of why those things are happening as well, and why that is different to some of the other typically developing children.
I think as well, sometimes as teachers, we put so much in place for our children, and we also almost don't realise we're doing it because it just becomes a natural part of their routine. But actually, you are providing that special educational provision in a lot of ways. If you're providing a sensory den, or you're providing a 10-minute movement break, and I know your child delivers a message to an office every day because they need to get, that's still special educational provision. And you're providing that, whether you're consciously providing it or not.
I just got back precisely about this the other day, and they were saying, oh, essentially, they said, we didn't think we did a lot to support that child. But everything they'd set up to that point had been, well, we managed the classroom this way because they're sat in this particular location, and there was all those other children sat in these other locations, and we have this top point in the day when we do this thing, and then that child has this. You know, and there's all these structure that they put in place to ensure that this child can remain well-regulated throughout the day. And so all of that, the educational provision, you're putting that in place for them. It's good for everybody, but actually you put it in place primarily for that child. That is all the stuff that you're doing. So it might not contribute, you might not be able to define it as 15 hours of additional support or whatever else you might want to put against it. But actually you are doing a whole lot of stuff there, and you can write that about your evidence. That is what you're doing. You're doing all that stuff to support that.
Yes, definitely. Which has kind of brought us full circle, really, because that's what we started off with, isn't it? That idea that actually, for many people, I think we don't realise how much we have put in place to support individual children, and that actually we have, I'm sure, developed a whole range of things, strategies that we've put in place that work for our children, all kinds of things, when actually we often don't notice them. We don't feel that we have any level of expertise in working with children with special educational needs, and yet we often have.
Yeah, we have.
So often good practices, good SEN practices is so often the case.
Yes.
And many of the things that everybody does are actually really good practice for children with SEND without them necessarily realizing.
Gareth and Louise, it has been fantastic to talk to you both. It's been really, really interesting. And you make such complete sense, both of you. I love the way that you talk about all of the things that we've talked about very much are about the sort of the key principles of effective practice, aren't they? You know, we're not talking about something completely different for children with special educational needs. We're actually talking about meeting their needs through doing something that often will work well for all of the children as well, all of the other children. So yeah, no, it's made complete sense to me, and it's been really interesting to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
You're very welcome.
No, thank you.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found the episode useful. Now you can stay in touch with all things Early Excellence by joining our mailing list and also, of course, following us on all of the social media platforms as well. Okay, have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.